Thank you. Thank you, Craig. On November the 28th, 1660, the Royal Society was founded in London. With the motto, Nullius in Verba, take no one's word for it, it quickly became England's principal forum for the practice and dissemination of experimental, natural and mechanical philosophies, those 17th century intellectual categories that would become modern science. Its early membership included some of the heroes of the scientific revolution, Robert Boyle, Robert Hooke and Isaac Newton, and I show you here the Society's greatest hits, Robert Boyle's air pump, Newton's Principia Mathematica and Robert Hooke's Micrographia. But in its early years, the Society's intellectual mandate extended far beyond the familiarly scientific. In its meetings and its publications, it promoted research into phenomena that would now lie comfortably outside the scientific corpus. This included material of an antiquarian, anthropological and philological nature, as well as that relating to surveying and architecture. Indeed, the presence in the Society of intellectuals such as Hooke, Christopher Wren, John Evelyn and John Aubrey meant that it was the principal forum in England through which architectural and antiquarian material was disseminated up until the founding of the Society of Antiquaries in 1707. Today I want to talk about one particular moment in the Royal Society's early engagement with both architecture and the antique, its publication of the first account in the English language of the architecture and topography of Athens. This had been written by Francis Vernon, a Royal Society member, former diplomat and traveller, and I'm afraid no portrait survive of Vernon, so you're going to have to put up with the fact that this is going to be a whole paper on someone you don't know who you don't know how he, what he looked like. I'm sorry. Vernon's account of Athens was in the form of a letter sent to the Royal Society from Turkey in 1675, and it was published in the Society's journal, The Philosophical Transactions, the next year. Vernon was an erudite observer and recorder of ancient buildings, and his account included brief but illuminating descriptions of the Erechtheion, the Theseion, and the Parthenon, the latter written over 10 years before the bombing of the temple by a Venetian army in 1687. Significantly, Vernon's letter predated more famous early publications on Athens, and in particular I'm referring to those by George Wheeler and Jacob Spon, published in the decade after Vernon, neither of which were related to the Royal Society in any way, though I'll be talking about them a bit today. So today I want to explore Vernon's short publication in detail, as well as his travel journal, which survives unpublished in the Royal Society's library. Together, they reveal much about the level of engagement that English scholars operated on with regards to ancient Greek architecture in this period. Vernon was amongst the very first Englishmen to see temples such as the Parthenon firsthand and in situ. Thus, both the account and the journal demonstrate Vernon's unfamiliarity with Greek classical form. But his writings also point to the ways in which English authors began the process of explaining these apparent deviations from the Roman norm. Vernon's account is also notable for the repeated emphasis that he put on the accuracy of his recordings, as well as his own competence as a witness. In this respect, I will argue that Vernon's exposure to natural historical discourse prior to his visit to Athens meant that his description of the ancient ruins was remarkably similar to accounts of naturally or experimentally produced knowledge that had been published also in the Transactions. I think Vernon's writings also raise interesting questions about the nature of accuracy in antiquarian publications in the period. But the most interesting aspect of Vernon, I think, is what they preempted. For many years after his death, the buildings that he would first record would come to have a profound influence on the development of British architectural design. In many respects, Vernon might be seen as the very earliest prophet of the Greek revival in Britain. So who was Vernon? He was born in London in 1637 and was educated at Westminster School and Christ Church College, Oxford. In both instances, he was a contemporary of the future curator of the Royal Society, the scientist and architect Robert Hooke. Vernon and Hooke would remain friends throughout their adult lives, and they shared mutual interests, including architecture. Hooke was, incidentally, an architect, as well as a scientist. After Oxford, Vernon made an educational visit to Italy, and he was in Rome in 1667, before embarking on a diplomatic career. He went to Paris in 1669 as part of the English embassy. In the French capital, Vernon largely neglected his official duties in favour of immersing himself in the Parisian intellectual world. There he befriended two of the principal astronomers of the day, Gian Domenico Cassini and Christian Huygens, and through them kept up to date with the activities of the Académie Royale des Sciences in the city. This information he relayed back to Henry Oldenburg, the secretary of the Royal Society in London, in a series of letters that have recently been published as part of the Oldenburg Correspondent Project. After Paris, Vernon himself returned to London, where his services to Oldenburg and the Society led to him being elected a member in 1672. It was also around this time that he began planning an ambitious, self-funded journey through the Eastern Mediterranean and the Middle East. The impetus for this journey seems to have been his long-standing interest in ancient culture, which is revealed in his earlier letters from Paris and Rome. But this new journey would be a lot more hazardous than those earlier trips abroad. He was proposing to travel into Ottoman-held Greece, where very few English people had been before him. Indeed, he would become one of the very first modern Englishmen to set foot in Athens. So here's Vernon's journey, made on a little map by me. Vernon left London in 1673 and sailed from Venice in early 1675 across the Adriatic to the Dalmatian coast. He reached Split in July, where he began to keep his travel journal. His companions at this stage of the journey were an English traveller called Sir Giles Eastcourt, which I can't find any information about, really, as well as Spon and Wheeler, who began their more famous voyages in the Eastern Mediterranean alongside Vernon. The party was in Corfu in late July 1675 and subsequently travelled through the Ionian Islands to Zante, which they reached on the 4th of August. Here Vernon and Eastcourt parted company with Spon and Wheeler, who sailed through the Aegean to Constantinople. They would return to Athens the following year. Instead, Vernon and Eastcourt went directly to Athens and from there left for Corinth and the Peloponnese, which they did a little tour of, a little circular tour. On the 24th of September, during their stay in the town of Vitrinitsa on the Gulf of Corinth, Eastcourt fell ill and died, leaving Vernon to return alone to Athens via Delphi. Throughout October and November 1675, he resided in the city, sketching numerous ancient ruins and writing their measurements down in his journal. He also spent time with the few Western Europeans that lived locally. After leaving the city, Vernon spent a month in the Cyclades, where he was robbed of most of his possessions by pirates. By the end of 1675, he had reached Smyrna in Turkey, and from there sent a number of letters back to Paris and London. This included the letter to Oldenburg that was to be published in the Transactions. He then travelled to Constantinople, and from there through Turkey and into the Middle East. In September 1676, he was killed by a group of locals near Esfahan in modern-day Iran, apparently in an argument over the ownership of a penknife, which is presumably why no portraits survive of him, and which is why my little map shows a one-way voyage. News of his death reached London the following May, and was recorded by his friend Hook in the latter's diary, who claimed that he'd heard the ill news of poor Francis Vernon's death, killed by Turks with scimitars at Esfahan. Evidence from Vernon's letters and journals suggests that had he survived, Vernon's intention was to travel as far as India and then to return to London by sea. In spite of the distance he'd travelled before his violent death, Vernon's travel journal somehow made it back to London and was found amongst Hook's papers upon the latter's death in 1703, and here's a page from it. This document, which is remarkably well preserved given its provenance, reveals that Vernon's interest during his time in Greece and Turkey were predominantly antiquarian. Thus he recorded Greek and Latin inscriptions, as well as any interesting ancient buildings he saw. It seems to have been Vernon's intention to publish significant parts of this journal upon his return, and in his letter he wrote that Athens, quote, deserves a whole book to discourse of it well, which now I have neither time nor room to do, but I have memorials by me of all I saw, which one day, if it please God, I may show you. I think by memorials he was referring to this document. Unfortunately, his untimely death meant that the only record of the voyage that entered the public sphere was the letter, which was read by Oldenburg to the Royal Society on the 16th of March 1676, at which, quote, diverse members expressed their desires that this letter of Mr. Vernon might be printed, end quote. It appeared in the Transactions on the 24th of April 1676. One of Europe's premier intellectual journals, the Transactions had been created in 1665 to publish research and discoveries generated in and around the Society. In reality, it included only a small proportion of the letters and reports that were read to the group, and selection for publication depended on there being an informal consensus among the members that a piece was important enough to release into the wider domain. In the case of Vernon's letter, there was little doubt that this was the case. In fact, one of the principal reasons for the publication of the letter was the general prevalence of material relating to ancient architecture in the periodical. This often took the form of smaller parts of larger travellers' accounts that featured regularly. In particular, when an author was writing from a location in which the ruins of ancient buildings could be found, They often included accounts of these, sometimes with measurements, and very rarely with illustrations. Vernon's letter was not illustrated, I'm afraid. Some of these were from parts of Britain with surviving Roman ruins, places such as York, and I'll show you one of those later, or from the Mediterranean and the Near East. For the time being, here is the most extraordinary image that the Transactions ever published showing architecture. These are the ruins of Palmyra in Syria that were published in the Transactions in 1695 as part of a traveller's account, or a series of traveller's accounts, of the Syrian desert. Extraordinary image that I don't really have time to talk about today, I'm afraid. So knowledge of ancient culture, including architecture, was hugely prized by the society, and as a result, the publication of these accounts was an important part of the content of the early philosophical transactions. As Oldenburg, the journal's editor until his death in 1677, observed in an early volume, quotes, "'Tis our main business as well as to retrieve all valuable antiquities as to supply fresh discoveries, to recover good old helps, as well as to devise new. All our artifices are designed and appropriated to unlock the repositories of nature, to draw out her most concealed operations and rarities, to produce them with their best advantages and in their fairest ornaments for all good occasions. And whatever we find excellent in old Greece or Rome or more ancient monarchies, or in any one more happy part of the world, that in due season to communicate all over the world to as many as have the ingenuity to give them a hearty entertainment. Therefore, and in line with the Royal Society, I'm not quoting Oldenburg anymore. Therefore, and in line with the Royal Society's broader social concerns, information about ancient culture had an important utilitarian function. It would provide old helps for new problems. In the case of architecture, it would improve the base level of architectural knowledge in England at the time. Contemporary with the Oldenburg passage I've just read, Royal Society members such as John Evelyn were arguing that contemporary English architects were, on the whole, largely ignorant of the rules of classical architecture. As Evelyn put it in 1664, all the mischiefs and absurdities in our modern structures proceed chiefly from our busy and Gothic triflings in the composition of the five orders. What was needed, claimed Evelyn, was a safe, expedient, and perfect guide to ancient architecture in which the noblest remains of antiquity are accurately measured and perspicuously demonstrated, and the rules are laid down. End quote. This then was the context for Vernon's letter and one of the reasons why it was published, containing, as it did, accurate measurements of numerous ancient ruins. But the Society's eagerness to publish the Vernon account also stemmed from its novelty. As Oldenburg had argued, information about ancient culture needed to be harvested and safely and accurately relayed back to London from both, quote, remote and nearer parts of the world, end quote. Novelty and exoticism were often the driving factor behind the Society's interest in travel writing. In the world of the early Royal Society, previously unknown phenomena had an important epistemic status. Knowledge from different locations had the potential to shape the direction of the Society's interest, because the structure of the group's knowledge was open to change and was not fixed. Vernon's letter demonstrates that architectural knowledge could be included in this. In providing an account of important ancient buildings that the community had little prior knowledge of, his letter enhanced and developed the community's knowledge rather than just consolidating it. In this respect, it was particularly suited to the mandate of the transactions, as it contained brand new information relating to valuable antiquities that had previously dropped out of Western European knowledge. For Vernon's letter was also an important moment in English architectural and antiquarian culture as a whole. Up to this point, English knowledge of ancient architecture was almost exclusively limited to Roman material. As a result of European editions of ancient texts, such as Daniel Barbaro's 1556 Italian edition of Vitruvius and Claude Perrault's French translation of the same text in 1673, which I show here, that's the Barbaro edition, there's Perrault. English intellectuals were increasingly familiar with the principles of Roman architecture, although, as Evelyn's just told us, the majority of English architectural practitioners didn't know this stuff. People like Evelyn and Vernon did. And some of them, including Evelyn and Vernon, had even managed to travel to Italy and see Roman ruins firsthand. But Vernon's travels in Greece brought to light forms of ancient architecture that were completely novel to 17th century English scholars and not really included in any of these publications, those of Greece rather than Rome. In his letter, Vernon was clear that Athens and its architecture had come as something of a surprise to him. He told Oldenburg and the Society that it was, quote, the most worthy city to be seen for antiquities of any I have yet been at, end quote, implying that they would not necessarily have known this. This observation highlights the genuine novelty of Athens as an intellectual subject matter in late 17th century England, and is important to stress the paucity of English people's knowledge of the city in the years before Vernon and subsequently Spon and Wheeler. Although Greek statues, or at least Roman copies of Greek statues, were beginning to appear in large numbers in Western Europe and England, the Arundel marbles in the Ashmolean, for example, which were acquired in the 17th century, images of Greek cities and their architecture were extremely rare. Knowledge of Athens and its buildings was on the whole still limited to Pausanias' 2nd century account and an unreliable 1675 French text that I will discuss in detail later. Any new knowledge that came to light about a city that had played such a crucial role in ancient history, yet remained so elusive in the modern period, was a noteworthy moment. And Vernon's recordings also expand the community's knowledge of ancient architecture beyond the pages of the principal surviving source on the subject, Vitruvius, written, of course, in the 1st century BC. The Roman author's treatment of Greek architecture was brief and confusing when compared to his account of the architecture of his native city and its empire. And although Vitruvius was clear that there was a difference between the architecture of Greek and Roman buildings, he gave very few, if any, details of how that difference manifested itself. As we shall see, this is a problem that Vernon keeps coming back to when he himself confronted and recorded the Athenian buildings. Vernon's account, therefore, had the potential to advance the English intellectual community's knowledge of ancient architecture beyond that contained in surviving textual sources. However, I just want to introduce a quick caveat here. We have to be cautious in seeing Vernon and his fellow travellers' sort of epistemic conquest of Greece and its architecture as too big a step. It's important to remember that this was still the pre-neoclassical period. The now widely held notion that Greek buildings were either the fountainhead or the apogee of classical architecture would not be formulated until the 18th century. There was little sense in late 17th century writings of an awareness of a development in ancient architectural style from the Greek period to the Romans, only that they might be different in some way. In fact, chronology and dating were issues that most observers of ancient Greek architecture in this period either ignored or stumbled over. This is best evidenced by both Spon and Wheeler's rather infamous dating of the pediment statues of the Parthenon to the Hadrianic period. Vernon himself said very little, either in his letter or in his travel journal, regarding the dates of any buildings he encountered, or their place within a broader scheme of classical architectural development in the ancient world. Nonetheless, he was aware, through his own observations, that the buildings of Athens displayed marked differences from Roman examples. They were also, in many cases, better preserved. Indeed, Vernon's belief that Athens was the most worthy to be seen for antiquities reflected the fact that many of its structures were considerably more intact in 1675 than they are today. For example, he thought the Parthenon was as well preserved as the Pantheon in Rome, which of course now it isn't, but it was then. Nonetheless, the city that Vernon spent 2 months in 1675 was still a very different one, not only from today, but from Pausanias' Athens of 1,500 years earlier, remember, which is pretty much all Vernon has to go on before he gets there. Here is a rough, not particularly accurate sketch of the Acropolis in the 1670s, produced by a French draftsman. For starters, the Acropolis was now a castle. It had huge defensive walls that had been built by Frankish occupants in the 14th century and reinforced by Ottoman forces in the years since they took the city in 1458. Many of the buildings that ancient authors described had disappeared or had been altered dramatically. For example, the Propylaea, which is just out of shot here, was described by Pausanias as unrivalled for its beauty, but by this time was incorporated into the defences and was largely obscured by the 26-metre-high Frankish tower, this thing here, that had been built in the 14th century. The other Acropolis temples had fared just as badly. The Erechtheion had been converted into a church in the Middle Ages, and according to Wheeler, was in the 1670s used as a harem for the Ottoman commander of the temple, of the castle. The Temple of Athene Nike was still standing and was amongst the best preserved buildings on the site, but its use as a powder magazine by the garrison meant that it was largely inaccessible. Vernon noted in his journal that one could only view the front of it. Even the Parthenon had been dramatically altered since antiquity. This is not a very clear image, but this is a 20th century reconstruction of what the Parthenon looked like in the mid-17th century, essentially before the Venetians blew it up. Around the turn of the 7th century, the Parthenon had been converted into a church, involving fairly drastic changes, and then into a mosque in the 1460s, which was a less invasive procedure. In Vernon's time, it had a minaret, as you can see, that had clearly been a that had previously been a Christian watchtower. The interculminations had been closed off halfway up the interior, and the interior, which included a 12th century apse, which I don't think you can see in this image, was a jumble of Christian mosaics and windows punched rather horribly through ancient friezes. Travellers interested in the ancient architecture of the city, therefore, had to disentangle the ancient ruins from more modern buildings. They also had to avoid the attention of the Ottoman garrison on the Acropolis, who were suspicious of any Westerners viewing, let alone measuring their fortifications, lest the information be passed to the Venetians. Given what would occur in 1687, they were probably right to hold such views. For Vernon, however, it meant that much of his activities on the Acropolis took place outside of daylight and at least once under musket fire from above. But in spite of these trying circumstances, Vernon managed to take measurements of all the major buildings on the site. These he related to Oldenburg and the Society in the 1675 letter, which began with an account of the Parthenon, giving all its important measurements down to the circumference of the pillars and the distance of the intercolumination. He also assured Oldenburg that he had taken all the dimensions within and those of the pronos and the porticos, but they are too long for a letter. And here I've got, this is from Vernon's published letter. These are the measurements, these are some of the measurements he gives us in the travel journal. There's more than this as well, actually. But as you can see, they're extensively, there's a lot more in the journal that Vernon had taken down compared to what ended up in the letter. Vernon also gave a brief description of the frieze and pediment carving in the letter, but again, his journal contained a much richer account. Next, Vernon turned to the well-preserved Theseion on the Agora, which he noted was like the Parthenon, a Doric building of white marble. He again gives measurements. He next turned to the Charagic monument of Lysicrates, which he decided was a temple dedicated to Hercules, based on the representation of the demigod in the carved frieze. He also described the Tower of the Winds, an octagon with the figures of eight winds, which are large and of good workmanship, according to Vernon. He also talked about the Erechtheion, and I'll deal with the Erechtheion later because he has his own particular take on that that I want to explore in detail. He discusses the various buildings built by Hadrian in the city and what was left of the Panathenaic Stadium. He also discussed the Odeon of Herodes Atticus, which again I will return to later because it's a really important building in the letter. For all of these, brief measurements were given, and as I've shown, normally a fraction of that contained in the journal. What were Vernon's reasons for providing his correspondence with these measurements? On the one hand, I think they provided information that architects or scholars might have found useful, and they also increased the community's knowledge of the dimensions of ancient temple architecture. But they were also, I argue, part of a standard natural historical textual apparatus that Vernon deployed to make his account seem more credible. In the letter, he assured his readers that they could rely on his measurements as exact a half a foot. This explicit reassurance of the accuracy of his recordings betrays Vernon's previous exposure to the content of the Philosophical Transactions and to Royal Society literature in general. Accurate mensuration was, of course, important in any account of architecture in the period, but in the Society's journal, it was particularly appropriate. As the historian of science Stephen Shapin has observed, numerical precision was highly prized by the Society, not just because it yielded important information about phenomena, architectural, natural, or otherwise, but also because it endowed the text with a layer of circumstantiality. Precise measurements were much more plausible than vague or approximated accounts of the dimensions of things. Thus, in Vernon's case, the apparent precision of his measurements and his assurance to that effect was evidence that he had viewed the buildings in person. As we will see, it was particularly pertinent for him to do this in the case of Athens. In fact, Vernon's letter contained other devices that enhanced credibility through circumstantiality. Again, these point to his prior knowledge of Royal Society literature. For example, in the Transactions, his letter was published in its original form as a letter, complete with the address to Oldenburg and Vernon's excuse for not writing to him earlier. It also contained a significant amount of circumstantial detail, including information about travel arrangements and the fact that Vernon had lost all his previous correspondence with Oldenburg when he was robbed by pirates. This was common in travel accounts in the period and in Royal Society-related travel literature in particular. A certain amount of scene setting such as this was often included to emphasise that an author had indeed been to the destination described. Indeed, in his travel journal that he intended to publish on his return, Vernon made further provisions for circumstantial reporting. Here he resorted to another tactic common in early Royal Society writings, the recording of phenomena as discrete events rather than generalised statements. As the historian Peter Deer has noted, society members like to record the results of experiments as an actual event that had taken place at a specific time and place. Vernon applied this method to his archaeological recording in Athens. For example, when he wrote down his measurements of the Thesion, he recorded the date he had taken them down, as well as the identity of witnesses, noting that the measures, quotes, were taken on Friday, August the 30th, with Mr. Randolph and Mr. Giles. Mr. Giles is that chap that died halfway through the journey. Mr. Randolph is a guy called Bernard Randolph, who's the English consul in Smyrna that comes across the Adriatic to join them for a week. This grounded the act of measuring in reality. It had happened at a specific time and was witnessed by a pair of trustworthy English gentlemen. Presumably, had he been able to publish the journal, he would have gone to similar lengths in the text to describe the actual circumstances under which his recordings took place. The letter also follows Royal Society conventions by including a certain amount of mathematically driven analysis. This manifested itself in the Parthenon measurements, and here we can see him calculating that the interculmination was 1.25 times the diameter of the columns, which says that. And actually, if we go to the journal now, we note that he's worked out the diameter of the columns by dividing their circumference by pi, like all good mathematicians. So in this, I know this is nasty 17th century handwriting, but here he notes down the circumference of the pillars. Then he writes, hence diameter, which is him doing his little calculation, as opposed to actually measuring the diameter itself, which would be a lot harder. Vernon's use of mathematics, albeit on a fairly simple level, is common in both the letter and the travel journal. Indeed, he seems to have identified himself as a mathematician first and foremost. Jacob Spon, who travelled with Vernon and would himself measure the Athenian ruins the following year, noted both Vernon's mathematical skills and his knowledge of architecture, calling the Englishman a skilled mathematician and architect. The later French traveller Joseph Piton de Tournefort also described Vernon as a learned mathematician rather than a traveller or an antiquarian per se. Vernon's apparent presentation of himself as a mathematician and his awareness of the conventions of Royal Society literature led to his Athens account being compared favourably to other, more overtly scientific publications in the journal. In the preface to the volume of the transactions that contained the letter, its editor, Oldenburg, discussed the role of the diligent travel writer and recorder of architecture, contrasting that figure with more, quotes, romantic authors, end quotes. In particular, Oldenburg praised, quotes, those learned and inquisitive writers who have searched deep into the antiquities which have happened in the places they undertook to describe. And we must acknowledge many excellent, ingenious, and truly philosophical histories of the architecture and grandeur and situation of palaces, cities, citadels, fortifications, towns, bridges, etc. In our designated natural history, we have more need for severe, full, and punctual truth than of romance or panegyric. Some travel writers, Oldenburg noted, were inclined to write romantic evocations of places, but not those of the Royal Society. Instead, Vernon's sober account of Athens was an example, according to Oldenburg, of natural history. It was analogous to accurate reports of natural phenomena that appeared regularly in the journal. But Oldenburg had another reason for contrasting Vernon's full and punctual truth with other texts that, quotes, do rather belong to arts and artifices, end quote. For Vernon's letter, besides providing measurements of the architecture of Athens, also confronted directly a particularly pernicious example of just such a romance. As I have already outlined, there are numerous reasons why the Society was so keen to publish the letter, but one outweighed all the others, I think. This related to a single building discussed in the text, neither the Parthenon nor the Erechtheion, but a structure viewed with considerably less reverence today, the Odeon of Herodes Atticus, built in 161 AD on the south slope of the Acropolis, so in the Roman period, essentially. Vernon, like all authors on Athens until the 19th century, referred to this building as the Theatre of Bacchus, thinking that it was the Theatre of Dionysus referred to by Pausanias, if you see what I mean. Pausanias' Theatre of Dionysus would later be revealed to be the theatre over here to the south of the Odeon, which is a much earlier building, but in this period so ruined you could hardly see it. So everybody, including 18th century authors, thinks this is the Theatre of Bacchus. Regardless, This was the last building discussed in Vernon's published Athens account, and as he had done with its predecessors, he set about recording its measurements. And this is again expressed mathematically. So he says the semi-diameter, which is the right sine of the demicircle, which makes the theatre, is about 150 feet. However, he quickly broke off from this to address a serious problem that he had identified in the existing European corpus of knowledge on ancient Athenian architecture, and on this building in particular. This realisation was of such importance that I think it renders Vernon's letter amongst the most valuable architectural documents in circulation in 1670s London. Although I have repeatedly stressed the novelty of Athenian architecture to Vernon and his English contemporaries, his account of Athens had not been the first to enter the London public sphere. That distinction belonged to a French publication called Athens Ancient et Nouvelle, which had been published in 1675, the year before Vernon's letter reached London, by an author named Georges Guillet de Saint-Georges. In it, Guillet related a tale of a voyage to Athens that had purportedly been undertaken by his brother, who he calls Le Guillotieri. It contains descriptions of various Athenian buildings and the topography of the city. In reality, however, Guillet had never been to Athens, and furthermore, his brother did not even exist. Instead, the book was a combination of extracts taken from a contemporary and very brief account of Athens provided by a group of French Capuchin monks, alongside pieces of outright fiction, and it is majority fiction, actually. Although it was not necessarily unusual for travel writing in this period to be based on accounts of others as opposed to first-hand experience, Guillet's book was unusual in that it presented a first-person travel narrative that purported to be genuine. As a result, a number of European scholars assumed that Guillet's book was trustworthy and had come from direct knowledge of the city. We know from his journal that Vernon possessed a copy of Guillet when he visited the city, and he must have quickly realised that the French text was inaccurate. He also knew that no one back in London, or Paris for that matter, would have been aware of this fact. Vernon is the first person to get to Athens post the publication of this text. To Vernon, the most obvious example of Guillet's disingenuousness was in his description and representation of the Odeon of Herodes Atticus, the only building illustrated in the French text. I'm not going to show it yet, I'm saving it up because it's quite funny. He immediately warned Oldenburg and the society. Monsieur de la Guillet, in that book, he has written of Athens, this quote says Vernon, So Monsieur Guillet has made a cut of the theatre, which he calls that of Bacchus, which is a mere fancy and an invention of his own, nothing like the natural one, which I judge he did not know. I give you this one hint that you may not be deceived by that book, which is wide from the truth, as will appear to anybody who sees the reality, though to one who hath not seen it, it seems plausibly written. Right, here it is. Guillet's illustration, which is completely nonsensical in some respects, although perhaps in other respects not, shows a building made up of a large semicircular substructure reminiscent of Roman theatres, this thing, with a plan of elevations that seem to me to be look like a sort of amalgam of the Colosseum and the Theatre of Marcellus, although if anyone can spot a direct source for it, it's almost certainly Roman, whatever it is. It had a scheme frons with a pitched roof and Doric pilasters, and an imagined perspective backdrop, which is brilliant, sort of Inigo Jones style. And perhaps most ridiculously, a square stage and wooden balustrade that resembled early modern playhouses. Its ignorance of the actual elevations, I'm going to be cruel to Guillet now and show it next to the building. Its ignorance of the actual elevations, not to mention the fact that the seating of the real theatre was cut into the slopes of the Acropolis, confirmed Vernon's suspicion that neither Guillet nor his fictional brother had been to the site. I should say that this is 1950s seating, but in Vernon's time it had the remains of its Athenian of its ancient seating, but it's cut into the side of the hill. Vernon's exposure of this duplicity was, I argue, hugely significant. In the world of the early Royal Society, exposing false information was as important as collecting accurate knowledge of phenomena. The Guillet account and reconstruction were epistemically dangerous. They had the potential to cause considerable damage within the architectural knowledge community. As Vernon was well aware, very few people in Western Europe had first-hand knowledge of the ruins of Athens, and there was a real possibility that learned architects and scholars might have been duped by Guillet's seemingly plausible book. Perhaps this may have even happened to Vernon's friend, Hook, who recorded in his diary that he had borrowed the Guillet text from an acquaintance in June 1675 and then subsequently bought a copy for himself a week later, which he then lent to Robert Boyle. This took place 8 months before Vernon's letter reached London, and Hooke's eagerness to buy and subsequently circulate the book suggests that he may have admired it. There is certainly no hint in Hooke's diary that he, or Boyle for that matter, suspected the French account to be disingenuous in any way. For Vernon and the Royal Society, then, Guillet's text presented a particularly troubling example of mendacious information masquerading as matter of fact. A plausible untruth such as this could spread like a virus in the knowledge community and lead to a serious loss of reputation and credibility for anyone taken in. In this case, the stakes were particularly high. Like many ancient building types, Greek and Roman theatres were of great interest to architects in this period, and surviving Roman theatres were used as source material for new buildings. Wren, for example, used his knowledge of Roman theatres in his design for the Sheldonian Theatre in 1664. The consequences would have been extremely serious if an architect as respected as Wren or Hooke had, in good faith, used Guillet's shoddy reconstruction of the Odeon of Herodes Atticus as an architectural source. Therefore, Vernon's account was a hugely important remedy to a dangerously unreliable text, and the Royal Society's eagerness to publish it is understandable. The minutes for the meeting when Vernon's letter was read out reveal the group's overall concern in this respect, and they say that there was read a large letter by Mr. Francis Vernon, giving a summary account of his observations and taking notice of Monsieur de Guillet's description of Athens as containing many mistakes and falsities, though plausibly written, end quote. So the minutes of the Royal Society pick on the apparent plausibility of Guillet. The Society agreed with Vernon that the apparent plausibility of the text rendered it a particular threat. This was also the reaction of Henri Gestel, one of Oldenburg's Parisian correspondents, who had been another to receive a letter from Vernon warning him about the book. Gestel wrote to Oldenburg, telling him that Mr. Vernon, quotes, has written to me from Smyrna his adventures and his description of Athens, where he has well remarked on everything with exactness. Athens antique et moderne, of which much has been made, is not real and is full of mistakes. End quote. Gestel noted the seriousness by which some scholars had treated Guillet, including perhaps Hooke, but he also highlighted the antithetical exactness of Vernon's account. As is apparent from these sources, Vernon's revelation sent a convulsion through the European knowledge community. It was up to the Royal Society and its mouthpiece, the Philosophical Transactions, to remedy the situation by circulating Vernon's news. The publication of this revelation had a number of immediate consequences, the first of which seems to have been that Hooke got rid of his copy of Guillet. It was not present in the sale catalogue of his library that was compiled after his death. Secondly, it is likely the removal of the illustration of Herodes Atticus from the English translation of Guillet came about as the result of Vernon's expose, and this translation was prepared as the letter arrived in London, so I wonder whether it would ever have even taken place had it not, had the letter arrived earlier. But this translation did not include the illustration, nor did it mention it in any way. The third consequence was that Spon and Wheeler, when they returned from their travels later in 1676, went to town on the French text. In doing so, they both invoked Vernon and his letter. Spon, for example, reprinted Vernon's letter as part of a whole publication dedicated to savaging Guillet's claims, which I show here. Wheeler likewise cited his fellow English traveller in the numerous refutations of Guillet that can be found in his journey to Greece. This relentless and sustained attack left Guillet and his account forever discredited. For the remainder of this paper, I want to turn to Vernon's unpublished travel journal and look at it sort of a little more closely. It's a remarkable document, but one that up until now has entirely escaped scholarly attention. The journal provides evidence of how Vernon, I think, went about interpreting the architecture of Athens and how he might have presented that information in published form upon his return. As with the letter, there is a sense of an encounter with the unknown in the document. Take, for example, his description of the columns of the Parthenon, which he noted with genuine surprise were, quotes, of Doric order, but have no base at all. The fustio riseth immediately out of the pavement as if it grew. By fustio, he means the shaft of the column. The almost childlike naivety of these words, which is contrasted by Vernon's fairly sophisticated use of architectural terminology, reveals that this was an architectural observer who was largely, if not completely, ignorant of baseless Doric columns. Such features of ancient Greek temple architecture are but largely unknown in England at the time. Indeed, there is little reason why Vernon would know this fact, given that it is not mentioned by any of the ancient sources on Greek architecture that he took with him. This brings us to another important feature of his travel journal, the repeated references to the various texts that he read whilst he was viewing the ruins of Athens. These, of course, included Guillet, but also Pliny's Natural History, Strabo's Geographica, and Pausanias' account of Greece. Although the latter represented the most comprehensive ancient description of Athens, as I mentioned earlier, it actually contained very little architectural material and tended to concentrate on the contents of temples rather than their appearance. Instead, the one ancient text that Vernon made the greatest use of during his time at Athens was Vitruvius, which, though not directly related to Greek buildings, became Vernon's guide to the ruins. And by the way, I'm almost 100% sure that the edition, the specific edition that Vernon owned, was the 1556 Daniel Barbaro Italian edition. For reasons that are a bit boring, I won't go into them now, but I worked it out. Thus, Vernon had come to Athens with a small library designed to facilitate his understanding of the ancient architecture he would see. Once there, his reading was carefully planned and far from indiscriminate. For it is apparent that from his journal that Vernon catered his reading of classical texts around specific ruins. For instance, on the morning of the 4th of November 1675, he read the fourth book of Vitruvius, which includes the account of the Doric Order, and then spent the afternoon viewing the Thesion on the Agora, which of course is a Doric temple. On the 6th of November, Vernon recorded that he had read Vitruvius's fifth book on theatres, and then went out to see the theatre of Bacchus. He had evidently jettisoned Guillet's account by then, in favour of the Roman author's more generic discussion of ancient theatre architecture. Furthermore, he occasionally considered passages of Vitruvius whilst on site. Thus, on the 10th of November, he wrote in his journal Porticus Hypethros during a viewing of the Parthenon that he was engaged in. This is a reference to the section in Vitruvius on hypethral temple porticos in which the Roman author discussed octastyle temples as well, such as the Parthenon. It's the only moment in Vitruvius when the Roman author talks about octastyle temples. Vernon's reasons for this seem to stem from his interest in identifying moments where the architecture of the buildings he was viewing differed from the account in Vitruvius. His account of the Parthenon represents the best evidence of this. In his description of the temples and tablature, he noted, and I'm going to quote a passage from Vernon that won't really make much sense, but then I'll explain it afterwards, if you see what I mean. So this is Vernon's take on the tablature. He says that over the comatium of the triglyphi should come the soffitta of the cornice plane, but 18 giocioli graven on it. But here these giocioli are done on plain tablets some 3 inches deep, which shoot out under the soffitta of the cornice after the manner of modillions. What Vernon is basically saying here is that the mutules of the entablature, these lumps here, are raised, they come out from the soffit. This is the illustration in the Barbaro Vitruvius, which incidentally is drawn by the architect Andre Palladio, in which, as you can, they're not present, these things are incised up into the soffit, as opposed to in the Parthenon. Although this may seem like a fairly minor point to us, it's probably sort of a bit nerdy that I'm interested in it. This was an age in which the minutiae of Vitruvian architectural theory was taken very seriously indeed. It also provides evidence of Vernon's conception of a norm in ancient architectural knowledge that was the measure by which any newly discovered ancient building was judged. Discrepancies from that norm were crucial and needed to be noted down because they had the potential to develop the community's knowledge of the subject beyond the now familiar textual sources. And there's another example of this here, which I'm not going to read out, but Vernon basically compares the capitals of the Parthenon to Vitruvius's description of a Doric capital and says that this should be here, but in the Parthenon it's not, if you know what I mean. These observations demonstrate Vernon's erudition when it came to architectural analysis, and in this respect his writings again fall in line with other Royal Society publications. In an account written by the physician and antiquary Martin Lister of the Roman Multangular Tower in York that was published in the Transactions in 1683, a similar level of erudition can be observed. In this text, Lister uses his measurements of the ruin to open up an informed discussion of the size of Roman bricks. In particular, he identified a discrepancy between the Barbaro edition of Vitruvius and the account of bricks in Pliny's Natural History. He was then able to use the York ruins to successfully argue that the Barbaro text contained an error. For English intellectuals in this period, the viewing of ancient buildings could often be a catalyst for a debate about the boundaries of architectural knowledge. This combination of pseudo-archaeological recordings and textual analysis largely drove the development of the community's knowledge of ancient architecture. And it is clear that Vernon intended the content of his journal to contribute to that process upon his return. The document is also notable for combining this textually informed analysis with measurements and sketches of the major buildings Vernon saw. Most of these take the form of sketch plans, and in this respect they differ from Spon and Wheeler, whose published images of Greek buildings were nearly all perspective drawings. I'll show a few of them in a minute. However, given his subsequent admonition of Guillet, the most important question with regards to these sketches must be, just how accurate are they? Well, the answer has to be, I'm afraid, not very, or at least not by our standards. Indeed, to the modern observer, some of them seem to be so startlingly inaccurate, it is hard to believe that they came from the hand of Vernon, the original censor of Guillet. This can best be seen in Vernon's illustration of this building, the architectural oddity on the Acropolis, the Erechtheion. I show Vernon's plan of the Erechtheion here next to a modern archaeological plan of the temple, so obviously this is Vernon's, this is a modern drawing. When compared to this, Vernon's drawing of the Erechtheion is willfully inaccurate, showing as it does two identical porches to the north and south of the cella, rather than the unequal porches, the south being the famous caryatid porch, that are such a feature of the building today. So here is Vernon's two identical porches on the building itself. You have this much smaller porch set back from the main entrance portico, and that is the famous caryatid porch there. Why would an author who so emphatically stressed the accuracy of his recordings do this? And this is not the only inaccurate plan, I'll show you some others in a minute. The answer must lie, I think, in the way in which accuracy was defined in pre-archaeological scholarship. As we have seen, Vernon was not alone in proclaiming his precision as a recorder, and Oldenburg, Justel and Spon all praise his exactness. Given that Vernon was deemed so accurate by the standards of the 17th century, perhaps we need to evaluate these plans and this plan and others he produced from a more culturally relative position. So how might this illustration be accurate by the standards of the day? Firstly, I believe that Vernon actually ignored the smaller caryatid porch in this plan because he almost certainly never saw it in the first place. In his accompanying notes and measurements of the temple, he made no reference to the structure. Neither do Spon nor Wheeler in their accounts of the building, which is surprising given its fame today. Perhaps the caryatid porch and the south wall of the temple were inaccessible at the time due to the actions of the Ottoman garrison, and given that it's a fairly small structure, it was probably obscured by later building work in the vicinity of the temple. Unfortunately, all that building work has been cleared away in the 19th and 20th century, so if I was an archaeologist, I may be able to reconstruct what the Ottoman buildings were on this site, but I'm not. Maybe someone will one day. But from Vernon's account and from other accounts in the period, it seems that this was not visible. The only one of Vernon's ancient authors to discuss this temple was Pausanias, whose account of the building is completely garbled, and he makes no reference to the caryatid porch. So what I think Vernon saw was that, which is I think I'm fairly sure about that. But this does not explain the inclusion of a symmetrical porch in place of the absent caryatid porch on Vernon's plan. This porch, and I'm talking about this one here, must be, I think, hypothetical and be based on his prior knowledge of Roman architectural principles, Roman, not Greek. Indeed, Vitruvius makes reference to temples in Rome that had two symmetrical porches either side of an entrance portico. The now lost temple of Castor and Pollux in the Circus Flaminius in Rome was, for Vitruvius, the best example of this type. Vitruvius also claimed that a temple with such an arrangement existed on the Athenian Acropolis, though the Roman author's wording here is vague and anecdotal, to say the least. Regardless, in its symmetry, Vernon's plan of the Erechtheion follows the general principles of Vitruvian architectural theory. It was an accurate reconstruction based on the norm that guided much of Vernon's analysis of Greek architecture. It essentially matches Vitruvius' description of these types of temples with two identical porches. That the temple may have at one point lost its other symmetrical porch would have made sense for Vernon. Of course it hadn't, it always had a porch there, but he didn't know that. But it would have made sense to him because he was aware that the temple had suffered since antiquity, and he recorded in his journal that it had been, quote, ruined by fire in the intervening years. In this respect, Vernon's plan was typical for late 17th century antiquarian images of ancient architecture. In this period, a certain amount of doctoring to remove more modern interventions and tidy up ruined structures was expected in architectural representations, and in no way jeopardised their perceived accuracy. Here are Spon and Wheeler's illustrations of the Parthenon, for example, which completely tidy up everything. They get rid of the minaret, they get rid of those windows that have been punched in the side of it, they restore the roof, they remove the intercolumniations. But there's no question of these of the, of the accuracy of these images being questioned. Vernon did likewise with his plan of the Propylaea, in which he left out the medieval fortifications that had subsumed the original temple. If this plan was accurate by the standards of our day, the Frankish tower would sit abutting the entrance steps here. Vernon doesn't show it. Here's another example from that Martin Lister account of York I was showing. Here's Lister's illustration of the Roman walls of York, which appear to have been airbrushed. And this, I think, is sort of fairly common in antiquarian imagery at the time. At no point was the accuracy of any of these images questioned in English sources. Such tidying up even applied to Vernon's drawing of the Odeon of Herodes Atticus, that one building that Guillet had so famously laid up. In his sketch of the exterior elevation, which is, as you can see, very rough, I'm afraid, he seems to have taken the surviving fragment with its two-story arcade and extended it the length of the facade. I should say that there's no point in really comparing this to the existing building because it's been so heavily restored in the 20th century. But if you compare it to an later 18th century drawing of the theatre, you can kind of see what Vernon's doing here. He's noticed that there's a couple of arches on top of the others, so he's sort of beginning to add them. I think he's sort of restoring what he thinks the original elevation is doing. In conclusion, though this drawing and the other plans are not what we might want from Vernon, given his contempt for Guillet's illustration of the Odeon, I think that we can at least make sense of it based on the antiquarian conventions of the day. These were accurate within the boundaries of existing textual knowledge and were designed to show ancient architecture in its entirety, unspoilt by subsequent interventions or damage. As Vernon never made it back, he never got to prepare any of these plans for publication, and in general, although his letter was the first English account of the city, it was very brief compared to what he had been planning to publish had he survived. Indeed, his journal provides ample evidence that Vernon had more than enough material for a single publication on Athens, and although it would have been less ambitious than later 18th century volumes on the subject, it would have certainly been more detailed than the accounts published by Spon and Wheeler in the years after Vernon's death. Neither of these authors included any plans of the buildings of Athens, and the illustrations in Wheeler's text in particular are rudimentary. I just showed you some. But Vernon's journal remained unpublished, and we are left to wonder how differently the course of British architecture might have been if this diligent recorder of ancient Greek buildings had returned and produced a relatively accurate and detailed account of the Athenian ruins over a century before the Greek revival became the dominant mode in architectural design in this country. Instead, it was Vernon's exposure of Guillet that would become his legacy. His sounding of the alarm over the fabrications of the French text ensured that subsequent literature on the subject of ancient architecture would be much more rigorously scrutinised. Initially, this manifested itself in Spon and Wheeler's critical mauling of Guillet, but questions of authenticity would continue to dog the recording of ancient architecture throughout the 18th century. This can best be seen in the work of the most famous British scholars to follow in Vernon's footsteps, James Stewart and Nicholas Revett, whose Antiquities of Athens, published between 1672 and 1794, would become the detailed English text on Athens that Vernon had originally envisaged. Stewart, in the third volume, again lauded Vernon as the most earnest and diligent inquirer during his short residence in the city, and once again republished Vernon's letter. Stewart and Revett generally tend to sort of be very rude about Spon and Wheeler, but they praise Vernon and think they consider Vernon the most accurate of their predecessors. But Vernon's legacy manifested itself elsewhere in Stewart and Revett's text. The famous illustrations in the Antiquity of Athens occasionally contained portraits of either of the authors, showing one of them drawing the ruins. As other scholars have noted, these cameos often serve as an important purpose in the text. They demonstrate that Stewart and Revett, like Vernon, Spon and Wheeler, though unlike Guillet and his fictional brother, had actually seen the ruins in person. Predictably enough, one such illustration was that of the Odeon of Herodes Atticus, still masquerading as the theatre of Bacchus. In this image, which was originally painted by Stewart and Guerche, Revett is shown clad in contemporary Greek dress, sketching the theatre from the shade of nearby ruins. It is hard to see this inclusion of Revett in this illustration as anything other than a reference to that small but intellectually significant moment that had taken place 100 years earlier, namely the denouncement of Guillet's fabricated image of the theatre through Vernon's first-hand account. Here, then, was a little memorial hidden in the principal textbook of the Greek Revival to the early Royal Society and to the letter of Francis Vernon, the first English recorder of the architecture of Athens. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.